resume a public hearing on House Bill 5008. And the director is with us until approximately 8:30 when he needs to go testify in another committee. And at that point, maybe we'll have a group large enough to proceed on Senate Bill 461. So, Mr. Nicewender?
Chair, no other opening comments other than we're, I believe, on page 11 of Bill's handout.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on page 11, we were going through the development of the governor's budget, and where we left off was in the current service level adjustments. And starting on page 11, we have current service level adjustments to phase in the operating costs for beds at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution at Umatilla that were opened in the current biennium, and phase up of the startup costs for those same beds. We also have operating and startup costs for the remaining beds at both TRCI and Umatilla and Snake River Correctional Institution that will open in 2001-2003 biennium. The current service level budget also has funds to operate and start up 400 minimum custody bed facility at Lakeview, and to operate 250 additional beds at existing minimum custody facilities in North Bend, Tillamook, and Baker City. As we proceed, you'll find both of those are postponed in the governor's recommended budget due to changes in the forecast and other reductions. We also have implementation of a security differential for non-security employees that are represented by AFSCME. Moving on to page 12, continuing current service level adjustments. Community Corrections Grants Program Unit, we have phase-in for new rates for the Senate Bill 1185 offenders that were approved by the 1999 legislature, and population changes in the October 2000 forecast. Debt service, current service level phases in debt service and certificates of participation that were sold in the 1999-2001 biennium. Capital improvement, there's elimination of one-time other funds expenditure limitations for inmate work program space, environmental compliance projects. And capital construction, again, elimination of one-time other funds, capital construction expenditure limitation that was approved for the 99-2001 biennium. And that takes us through the development of current service level. On page 13, I'll start to discuss the policy packages in the budget. In package 90, you'll see a package 90 in institutions, correctional programs, administration, central support operations program units, all the operational units of the budget. And I'll summarize what is in those reductions in all the package 90s, and as we go through the individual division presentations, we'll break that out and give you the specific numbers for each division. Overall, the governor's budget reduces the budget for the Department of Corrections by $33.3 million in general fund, increases $2 million federal funds, and eliminates 123 positions and 138.81 FTE, all from current service level. In the package 90s throughout the budget, you'll see elimination of inmate activities at six institutions and reduction of activities in a seventh. Those activities include such things as HIV awareness, anger management, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, various clubs and sports activities.
It's true.
Senator Troll.
I really think that these are very bad cuts. I don't know that I'm sure the governor didn't want to make them, but I really do think that they, in the long run, they could be very detrimental to us in terms of what happens within the prison confines, and I certainly hope that we can find some way to moderate some of these things.
I certainly share your point of view on that and some of the choices that were made in the budget. Hopefully we can rearrange.
Moving ahead, Mr. Chair, the package 90s eliminate the morning exercise yards at all institutions, leaving exercise yards in the afternoons at all of them. It anticipates additional savings from the department's centralized purchasing and distribution functions that were approved a couple of biennia ago. It anticipates increased federal state criminal alien assistance fund revenues based on fiscal year 99, history through fiscal year 99. Fiscal year 2000 receipts from the federal government were lower than expected, and the governor's revised budget backfills the reduction, as I believe the initial co-chair's budget did as well. Moving on, page 14, again, package 90 reductions. The Inmate Management and Transition Services, or IMATS, program that Dave mentioned earlier is implemented, which targets specific programs and specific institutions. The impact will be alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment at Two Rivers Correctional Institution will be eliminated. Education services will be eliminated at seven institutions, and health and volunteer programs will be reduced system-wide. Again, the concept of the IMATS program is to have particular programs offered at specific institutions and then house the inmates based on their needs for those particular programs.
Is that policy driven by reductions in budget or different management approach to what array of services you're going to provide at certain institutions? I mean, would you do this if you were flush with cash?
Senator Miller, Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I can't say that we would do everything in IMATS if we were flush with cash, but some of this is just good business, I think. It makes sense to do it. It was in part response to budget issues and in part to just sort of thinking through how can we deliver services. And I think that's what's confused the discussion around IMATS is, depending on which camp you're in, you see it as only a response to budget woes or as good management, and it's a blend of both of those.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Trowe.
Well, I would hope that we'd spend some time talking about alcohol and drug treatment, or what's happening to education services, those things with this this program reduction. So some of those things are really needed. And, talk about key things that keep people coming back. Drug and alcohol addiction has a lot to do with your clientele, and also education can make up some disadvantages these individuals have and make it possible for them to transition better. So it seems to me like we ought to spend some time with these.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Nicewander?
I know the committee, you think you partially answered that, and it's just basically a combination of things, but they were curious what kind of analysis went into this major policy change. Were there any other options considered?
Senator Miller, Mr. Nicewander, members of the committee, the array of services and how this will be accomplished, the discussion continues. It was a pretty immediate effort to get at targeting. Some thought had been going towards this for a period of time before we implemented this because of the budget building process. But a lot of how it's going to be done are things we're going to talk about in the next couple of days, including how we transition to that. Because as Senator Trowe says, this is not something you can do overnight and just musical chairs, everybody move, and now be happy with your lot in life. That's not going to happen. And where we have challenges like Snake River and Two Rivers because of the types of inmates, the lack of work activities there, and a number of other things, going about this slowly is our process. And both institutions, programs, community people, institutional folks, and everybody else are engaged in the conversation. And I think you're gonna hear more about it over the next several days, and sort of how it went about and where we're headed with it. And if people, I think part of this is some degree of patience with the concept, but also understand that we have a strong concern also, as Senator Trowe mentioned earlier, about some discussion about restoration in the event that there's method to do that, because we believe there are areas where this is too much.
All right, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing about midway down page 14. There's a reduction for funding for software, hardware, network projects, and staff training in the Information Systems Division. Positions are eliminated in institutions management and operations, fiscal services, human resources, community corrections, and administrative support. The Pendleton Inspection Office is closed, and there are reduction in growth and services supplies, capital outlay, and special payments. Moving on to page 15, you'll see a package 94 in the operations, different operations program units. That affects the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility opening. And overall, the budget reduces the funds for Coffee Creek by $7.1 million general fund, a slight increase in other funds, eliminates 15 positions and 30.53 FTE. The issues you'll see here is the length of the intake process is reduced to 22 days. That is shorter than had been planned initially when the budget for Coffee Creek was put together, but is still longer than the current intake process in the facility we have in the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. Volunteer and health services are reduced, inspections, business services, support staffing is reduced, and startup service and supplies and capital outlay are reduced by 15%. Package 95, affecting the Two Rivers Correctional Facility.
Is that facility already operational, or are these just projected reductions of projected costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, the facility is not yet open, still being constructed, will open during the...
Just reducing some things that you had projected would be the cost.
I believe that's the one up in the Wilsonville area.
Yeah, I understand. I asked that the other day. I wasn't sure where Coffee Creek was, but now I know.
Please proceed.
Tax 95 affects the new beds. The final beds will be opening at Two Rivers Correctional Facility, and there's reductions here, again, to eliminate the alcohol and drug treatment, mental health services for those beds, again, as part of the IMATS program, and a reduction in volunteer services as well. Package 96, as I indicated, the current service level had funding to open the 400-bed facility in Lakeview, based partly on budget reductions, partly on population changes. That's been postponed until the 2003-2005 biennium, so that eliminates almost $10 million in general fund. The construction of the facility will continue, and the opening will be expected in early 2003 biennium. Package 97, minimum expansions. Again, these were 250 additional beds that were included in current service level to open in 2001, toward the end of 2001-2003. The operation of those beds is postponed again until 2003-2005, reducing the general fund by about $6.8 million. Construction of the additional beds at those minimum custody facilities will continue, however.
Senator Trow? Sure.
Yeah, just are the projections justifying delaying these things so that we're not going to end up having a lot more people than we can handle?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, we believe we should be able to handle them given the current population forecast. There is some continued reliance on temporary beds in the institutions that we've been using now, and there may be some need for a small number of rental beds.
But we're not going to have to send a lot of prisoners out of state, or anything.
We won't be sending any prisoners out of state. Okay. Okay, so moving on to page...
Let me qualify that. Our intention is to not send any out of state, but given day-to-day events, I mean, that's... We believe our population management plan addresses the expected population.
Yeah. If that changes. Package 17, in the Correctional Programs Unit, page 117, I'm sorry. Package 121, the Correctional Programs Unit, the transition package we discussed briefly yesterday, $1.8 million general fund, two positions. That package establishes a therapeutic visiting pilot program at the Coffee Creek facility and the Columbia River Correctional Institution in Portland. It also funds upgrades to the incarceration transition information system and establishes a transition program management positions. In the administration program unit, package 145 has $2.4 million to fund to deal with the issuance costs and $106 million in certificates of participation proposed for sale in the 2001-2003 biennium. The COPs support the facility construction and maintenance program department. Moving on to page 18, package 164 in the Central Support Operations Program Unit, $990,000 general fund in one position. The department's accounting system is about to no longer be supported by the vendor, and an upgrade is critical or we'd be unable to continue to do the accounting work for the department. So that package deals with that. Debt service, package 550. There is a reduction of $14 million in general fund and an increase of $19 million other funds in debt service. The package funds the debt service and $106 million in new COPs. The reduction in general fund is because we have excess COP revenue from prior construction projects that we'll be able to shift debt service to as in a one-time basis in the 2001-2003 biennium. Excess earnings on the COPs, higher than projected, and its savings in construction costs, the various construction projects. Page 19, capital improvement, there's a $700,000 general fund increase in package 188. That will fund some of the critical facilities projects for the department. The department has about a $75 million deferred maintenance backlog issue, and this will help address some of those issues, including conversion of beds at the Columbia River Correctional Institution and the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution from women to men after Coffee Creek facility opens. Capital construction package 189 includes $3.9 million in general fund and $90.7 million in other funds for new capital construction projects, establishing a six-year expenditure authority for those projects. Now, the limitation for this is in the statewide capital construction bill rather than in the department's construction bill. So generally in the process is this committee will make a recommendation to a committee, which I believe is unnamed at this point, that will deal with all the capital construction issues at a later point in the session. The items that are in the capital construction list for 2001-2003 include the construction of the Lakeview facility, 400 minimum custody beds, cost of $27.2 million, funded with certificates of participation. Initial construction for the Madras facility, including 400 minimum custody beds, complete on-site development, and complete off-site infrastructure for the project that will eventually hold another 1,500 medium custody beds. The cost for the construction during the 0103 biennium is $59 million other funds, again, supported with certificates of participation. Page 20, again, continuing with the capital construction projects, the Shutter Creek Correctional Institution, addition of 100 minimum custody beds, $5.6 million other funds. We'll be supporting that with federal violent offender incarceration truth and sentencing grant funds that are allocated to the states for prison construction. There are several other projects at existing institution. There's a groundwater cleanup ongoing project at the Oregon State Penitentiary for $1.2 million general fund. There's the conversion of the Oregon Women's Correctional Institution to a men's facility after the Coffee Creek facility opens, $1.6 million general fund. And there's some roof replacement at the warehouse and distribution center of $1.1 million general fund. That's the capital construction piece. Moving towards a conclusion on page 21, the fee and revenue issues here are just the uncertainty regarding the state criminal alien assistance program funds and the use of excess COP revenues as a one-time offset against general fund debt service. We've done some rough estimates for you on roll-up costs in 0305, operational costs at Coffee Creek, Two Rivers, and Snake River beds, roughly estimated $20.4 million general fund. Phase out of the startup cost of those institutions, roughly a reduction of $12.4 million general fund. Debt service cost, including the elimination of the one-time shift to the excess COP revenues, expect an increase of debt service of $32.6 million general fund. And based on the population forecasts that occur at the time, we expect there will be additional beds at Lakeview, Madras, and existing institutions that will also be additional cost in 0305. Moving on to page 22, I'll quickly take you through the items in the governor's March 2001 revised budget. There is a backfill of the federal state criminal alien assistance program revenues of $3.5 million. Again, there's a shortfall there. General fund replacing federal funds. I believe that item is also included in the initial co-chair's budget. Funding for community corrections compact out population. These are offenders who are managed out of state. They're still cost by the counties to manage them at a fairly low level. We left those out of the governor's recommended budget. Based on the October forecast, that would add $1.6 million to community corrections grants. And again, I believe that was addressed in the co-chair's budget. The other issues the governor included in his revised budget was a required funding of an AS200 computer upgrade, which was left out, $724,000 for the Department of Information Systems to be able to continue. There was an error of about $188,000 in general fund on the computation of attorney general costs, and we've reserved $800,000 for population changes resulting from pending legislation that may occur during the biennium, such as the assault and public safety officer bills or other legislation affecting the prison population forecast. There's some other issues I need to bring to your attention. As mentioned earlier, based on the April 2001 forecast and a refinancing of certificates of participation that have already been sold, there's a savings of about $6.9 million. 3.2 of that comes from the April 2001 forecast. And as a result of that forecast, we are delaying some of the beds at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, including shifting 108 medium custody beds into 2003-2005 biennium. Also, there's a changes in the conversion of women's beds to men's beds. The women's correctional center conversion is accelerated, and the Eastern Oregon correctional conversion is delayed. And finally, there's an adjustment on the community corrections population changes. There's a reduction of $476,000. That is an adjustment to the governor's revised budget rather than the recommended. And the reason I'm showing it to you as a reduction from the revised is to allow an apples-to-apples comparison, because we had omitted the compact out population from funding in the governor's recommended. So when we're actually comparing the full population in October to the full population in April, properly funded, there's a $476,000 reduction. However, compared with the governor's recommended budget, there's about a $1.1 million increase to actually cover the April 2001 forecast.
Are these forecasts you're talking about bed forecasts?
Well, in this case, it's forecasts of populations of offenders on post-prison supervision, on probation, and local control or Senate Bill 1145 offenders. In terms of the COP financing issue, we refinanced $99.2 million in COPs that had been previously sold for the construction of the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. That generated $3.3 million in general fund savings in the 0103 biennium. We need to ask you for an increase in the 99-2001 other funds expenditure limitation of $107,455,000 in order to retire the original COPs that were refinanced. As I mentioned, the population changes in the COP refinancing generate $6.9 million in general fund savings. The department has a list of priority addbacks it will discuss with you to reinvest those savings within the agency. The governor will review the May economic forecast and other statewide issues before making his recommendation on the use of those funds.
Chair.
Senator Dro.
Are there restrictions on what you can use COP refinancing savings to do?
We would need to continue to pay off the COPs that were refinanced.
Okay, but you've got these savings.
Well,
okay.
I'm sorry, excuse me. No, the $3.2 million savings would not.
$6.9 million general fund is savings.
$3.2 of that is from the population forecast changes. $3.3 of that is from the refinancing. So
is there restrictions?
There's no restrictions.
No restrictions. No. Spend that within the budget.
Anyway. Within this budget or within other budgets.
But it's the money is in this budget at this point.
It is money in this budget at this point. And the department will have some priority issues they want to talk to you about reinvestment of those at some point. Governor has not taken a stand on those specifically, but those would be the sort of things that would be likely to be supported.
It could go for drug and alcohol treatment or anything.
The department, yes, that would be possible.
And what this committee might
at least think about.
Yeah. See how it plays in this middle.
Compare to what they're going to suggest, because maybe what they're suggest is needed, but maybe not.
To complete my testimony on page 24, the technical adjustments, there are a couple of areas where we shift funds between categories, such as special payments to personal services, just to correct errors in the governor's recommended budget. There's no net impact of those shifts. It's just to correct some errors, and that we also need to adjust position and FTE counts to correct errors in the governor's budget. That would require an addition of 16 positions and 6.61 FTE, but with no dollar impact, just the counts and the positions in the FTE. And the table below, you show what the governor's March 2000 revised budget and technical adjustments would be. It increases the general fund recommendation to $870 million and total funds to $1,020,000,000.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Crowell.
What's the position vacancy rate within corrections?
Mr. Chair, I don't have, the department will give you, I don't have.
You don't have that.
We can give it to you, I just don't have it in my head right now.
I think you guys would know that. Okay. Are there a lot of positions being held vacant generally or not?
Mr. Chair, there are two types of vacancies. When we have positions that will phase in a later point in the biennium of these institutions. There is some turnover. I don't believe, there are some positions that during the course of the biennium are held vacant in order to deal with funding problems in the department's budget. I don't have the percent with me today.
Are there questions? Well, thank you for your presentation. Mr. Nicewander?
Yes. Committee members, the co-chairs will be in here in just a moment where we can take up Senate Bill 461. They indicated that that would work for them in their schedule, and I'd probably recommend that we do that.
What we can do then is we'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 5008. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 461.
Thank you. Chair Mueller, committee members, I placed before you a copy of the Senate Bill 461A engrossed version, as well as Senate Bill 461-A6 amendments and a fiscal impact statement for the -A6 amendments. Basically, we had a hearing on this on April 4th, and at that time, I think we had the -4 amendments before us, which lifted the gallon requirement from 2,400 down to no gallon requirement. It's my understanding from talking to the lobbyist, Brian Bowe, that this A6 amendments represent a compromise agreement, and there is a restoration of the gallon limit to 900 gallons in the amendments before you. And there is one other amendment wherein the change to the law would allow those individuals who are operating a vehicle for a business that doesn't necessarily have to be owned by the business. So those two are the amendments that have been introduced. I don't believe either one of those are inconsistent with the letter that we received from the chair of the committee, Senator Beyer, that sent this bill here. So,
well, you're okay on the House side.
The fiscal impact.
Don't be so sure.
The fiscal impact before you reflects the additional workload resulting from the change in the gallon requirement, as well as some of the audit requirements of one FTE. As you'll note, the revenue increase is significant and will probably provide an opportunity for them to reduce the fees in subsequent biennia for the card lock program.
All right. I thank you, Mr. Bowe. Mr. Douglas, do you want to make some brief comments on the measure?
Mr. Chair, Brian Bowe, excuse me, representing the Oregon Commercial Fueling Coalition. I believe your committee staff did a good job summarizing the amendments. They were arrived at a consensus process and discussion amongst the parties of interest to the bill, and I believe it resolves the matter. Should probably note for the record that the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association did inform us that they are still opposed to the bill. Oh, in fairness to them, I just wanted to note that for record, but the other parties are in full agreement with the amendments and urge the adoption of the amendments and moving the bill.
Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 461? Come on up. Please identify yourselves for our record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brian Thompson. I'm on the board of the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. As Mr. Bowe said, we are still in opposition to the bill. In my opinion, these amendments would probably open the door wider, merely removing the 2,400-gallon minimum requirement. I think removing the requirement from the bill that the vehicle has to be owned by the business really opens the door pretty wide to a lot of people that would not have otherwise been able to use card locks. So that is the main reason why we're still in opposition to this. So.
My name is Brent DeHart. I also represent the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. I'm a Salem retailer and a member of the Board of Directors. I was a little curious about the comment from Mr. Bo about a compromise agreement, since to me this is a two-party issue, those who retail and those who do so-called non-retail fueling. If only the non-retail aspects agreed on the amendments, then it's not exactly a consensus compromise. I just want to make three points. The first point I think is the most important, that to further this bill, to carry forth with this bill, would be a public policy choice. It'd be a distinct decision to take gallons out of the retail sector, out of the stations that provide for the Oregonian public and its visitors, and move them into the non-retail self-serve sector. I don't think that's a good public policy choice. I think you will see fallout in the retail arena. You will see challenges faced by people who are serving the public, as opposed to a small segment of the public. My second point is that this isn't just going to hurt rural stations. I've heard another testimony this will hurt rural stations that are having a tough go of it. Well, I have a station in Salem. I've got a card lock on 1/2 mile from me on both sides of my station. Every month I wonder, every month I try to make that nut pay my bills, and this is going to hurt me too. It's going to hurt Portland dealers, it's going to Salem dealers, and it's especially going to hurt the rural stations. My third point, and in regards to that also, the way it's going to hurt retail stations is now, with these amendments, every Mary Kay distributor, every insurance salesman, every realtor, they're going to qualify for a card lock. A lot of these people are busy people. They're busy people, they're salesmen, they're on the move all the time. They burn a lot of gas, and because they're on the move all the time, they might be the type of segment of Oregonian who wants self-serve. Well, they're going to get self-serve, but it's going to be at our expense. And we cannot compete for those gallons anymore. The people who are busy and on the road, those salespeople, like I said, or in their own businesses, provide a great number of gallons that are sold in the marketplace. There's only so many gallons sold. Nothing's going to change how many gallons are sold. What's going to happen is the amount of gallons that are sold at a ghost station, an unattended station, is going to go up, and your retail attended station serving the public is going to go down. Okay, on to my third point. I feel that in some way, this promotes an agenda towards a self-serve, because it'll force the issue and tip the scales greater towards more people are using self-serve, and tip the inequity to such a point there'll be an uprising and a demand to make the playing field equal again. Although I've been a proponent of self-serve in the past, I don't think that promoting a self-serve agenda in this manner, which would promote it at our expense as retailers, is a fair way to go about it. I fear that our backs are not strong enough to bear the burden of furthering the pro-self-serve agenda in this direction. And that is all. Any questions?
I've obviously had some interest in this kind of legislation for a long time, and I understand the fear of competition. And I wonder why it is we continue to want to create a system that deprives the consumer of choice. Yeah. I understand what we want to do to protect a business, but if the consumer wishes to get a product in some other way where they are required to do the work themselves, how can we continue to, you know, set up a barrier to what the customer wants?
For me, I don't see this as, I'm pro-competition, and if I could compete in the same ways that the card lock could, I would not have any problem with this. But in my opinion, this is restricting the way that I can compete for customers and giving card locks a way to compete that I simply do not have any legal way to compete with them. So... in my opinion, you know, it's restricting competition, and that's what Brent's saying about shifting gallons, because we can't compete the same way that they can. It's not an even playing field.
because we haven't had the good sense to allow you to allow patrons to come to your premise and serve themselves.
I think, Mr. Chair, you get no argument from me in your perspective and restricting choice in the marketplace. But this the inequity was created by this esteemed body, and I feel it's a segment of the industry that should not have been existed in the first place. I don't mind a key lock or car lock situation, but when an Oregon judge ruled that they were retailing gasoline, I thought it was poor judgment to in Senate 10 years ago that the Oregon legislature chose to define card lock as not retail, when the judge had defined it as to the final consumer, which is the vehicle that burns it. The restrictions that were here were the price that segment paid for receiving legalized self-serve. They have legalized self-serve. And in exchange for that, they agreed to these restrictions so that we could coexist and still try to compete on not a level, but at least a reasonable marketplace. So anything backing away from those restrictions, we have to vehemently oppose.
Any other questions? Just as a brief side, are you encouraged at all by the hearings going on in the United States Congress and Senate with respect to the pricing schemes of major oil companies?
Speaking for the organization,
mm-hmm.
We encourage all efforts to for open and fair competition. And anything that evens the playing field. And the more players that we have in the market, the better it is for the public and better it is for the long term for all of us. So anything that limits the number of players by limiting competition would be bad.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 461?
I'm John Brown. I live at 470 Miller Street, Southeast in Salem, and I'm here today on behalf of the South Salem seniors, and we want to oppose any changes in bringing us nearer to self-service fuel, and we oppose that strongly, and I bring that to you that we do oppose this bill.
All right. Are there questions? Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Anyone else? 461. Now we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 461. Open a work session on Senate Bill 461. Senator Hannon moves the Dash 6 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the Dash 6 amendment.
Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the Dash 6 amendments are adopted. Senator Hannon?
I'd move Senate Bill 461 as amended to the full ways and means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannon moves Senate Bill 461 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation for approval. Is there a discussion?
Representative Canope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, I had problems with this original bill. I'm not a proponent of self-serve like yourself. Especially for the what I would consider the true retail community. I am with seniors and the my wife on this issue, I would say. Women in general.
Okay, I'll create another exempt class.
Why not? And I appreciate the esteemed co-chairs taking a look at this and allowing amendments to this when they didn't have to. And I truly appreciate that. I can support the bill with the amendments. And I appreciate the time that was taken and the negotiations that took place. As I say, I couldn't have supported what I considered a true self-serve bill, and I know we disagree on that point. But I think this is if it is a baby step toward allowing more businesses to get gas at card lock stations. And I think there's a compelling case for allowing that to happen. I do still have some concerns about how this can potentially affect the market between the gas dealers and the card lock stations. And you know, that's why we meet every biennium, and maybe you'd like to meet every year. But if there are significant hardships because of that. You know, we can always take a look at this again next session. But at this point, I think I can support the consensus amendment.
Thank you. Further, Senator Troll.
I'll join in supporting the bill as amended at this point, but I reserve the right to study it and perhaps change my mind when it gets to the floor.
And you don't use much gas anymore anyway,
that's
so what do you
true.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hanna.
I want to thank Representative Knopp for working with us on this, because I had no intention of trying to do something that didn't involve your participation. And I appreciate your willingness to work with us, and I want to thank you for it.
Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? If not, it is adopted. Senator Hannon, would you be so kind to carry that? You will.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And we thank you for coming to our committee today.
Thank you.
And you,
free donuts.
Representative
Leonard.
Leonard, you dressed awfully well today.
Okay,
huh?
Stay up and twist.
Yeah. Oh.
House carrier.
Thank you again. House carrier?
I'll do it.
Thank you. Okay, we close the work session on Senate Bill 461. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5008.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. While they're coming up, we are to the point where we begin the detailed discussion of programs and services, and the first program and service area that we will discuss today is the institution's budget. And I had placed before you a packet yesterday, and I placed another copy before you today with a few opening comments just to set the stage for what will follow and their detailed discussion. The institution's budget, again, is a very large part of their budget. As you can see from the table I put on page one, the general fund budget is, and the governor's recommended, is approximately $30 million below the general fund, below the current service level. When you compare it to the 9901 estimated expenses, it is about a 16% increase from $346 million to $403 million. And as well, there's an increase of approximately 377 FTE. The reductions from current service level, as Bill just outlined, relate to delays.
With the reduction in the general fund, where does the institution budget find additional monies? I presume that it's other funds. What's the source of these other funds?
Primarily, other funds are inmate welfare funds, as well as there's funds that they, you know, the correctional programs gets most of the contract funds. Heck, do you know the
SCAP
primary
dollars?
Other, their federal funds are SCAP. There's about $12.8 million total other funds revenue for institutions.
Ms. Chair, work crews, some sale of, well, I guess product sales is mostly programs. There's some inmate telephone use revenues as well. I think those are primarily the sources for the other funds.
And are these especially available this time, or are we just making a different use of them than we've made in the past?
Ms. Chair, these are pretty much the same revenues, other funds revenue sources that we've seen in the past. Some of them increases, the population increases, inmates, more inmates use telephones more, there's more canteen sales, but the other funds portion of this is, I think, pretty consistent.
But these are savings from expenditures, right? Or what? Or monies that we take in because of the telephone calls?
Yeah, that we are able to use in support of the institution's budget. If the inmates, I guess, were to stop using telephones, we'd have the cost that we'd have to find a way to cover, probably the general fund. So we are able to offset some general fund as well.
Is that the money coming from the welfare fund?
There are some revenues from the welfare fund here as well. But,
okay. We'll ask some more questions about that as we go on.
And I also want to advise the witnesses that House is convening this morning at 10 o'clock. So we've been shortened a bit, and I apologize to you for that, but we'll we want your total presentation, and won't if it's not complete today, well, then we'll have the privilege of seeing you Monday.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Page two, just to outline a couple of the issues. The department has provided you with information yesterday on management structure, span of control, that we can talk about. Additionally, we had asked for early on information for vacancies, and I just summarized some of that for you. The department has had significant vacancies in the institutions area. You'll see them also in the correctional programs area, and they can talk to you about the reasons for that. In large part, it's because the department has had to hold position vacancies to deal with unfunded compensation issues, cost overruns in health services, a variety of reasons. All to their credit, they have come to the e-board twice to rebalance in this last interim, and neither time did they request allocation of additional general fund money, so they balanced within existing resources. I have a list of the vacancies that I have summarized there for you. There are rebalance issues that were presented to the e-board there. Primarily, they had utility cost overruns. They had to make some adjustments relative to their population management plan, and they had to install an additional freezer at the distribution center. There are proposed reductions, as Bill has gone over them, and they'll go over them in detail in their presentation. I summarized for you in the last slide there, the spans of control for security, just so you could see at a summary level in the institutions. On the left side, the minimum custody, you can see the ratio of security staff is 1 to 5.13 at Powder River, minimum custody facility, and that goes from low to high there, this bottom end of that, South Fork at 1 to 14. On the right side, the medium custody facilities, the women's facility having the lowest management to staff ratio, and OSP having the highest. And we can talk about that in greater detail as they go through their presentation.
Can you go back on the one of your rebalance issues where the utility costs? How are we dealing with that in this coming biennium generally when we probably anticipate that the cost might go up a bit?
Chair Miller, members of the committee, Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I don't know that there is a statewide strategy currently to deal with that. We are dealing with it internally by, in some cases, switching to alternate sources of power that we have not used in the past. We watch the market. If it turns out that we have an ability in certain institutions, like I believe EOCI, to switch to natural gas instead of using electric power, then we're doing that, particularly for the heating. We're working on control units that can more finely determine the thermostatic settings. There are a whole array of things we're doing, but we are going to be, as much as everybody else, at the mercy of what happens. And if that happens, we're going to be back because we don't have the wherewithal internally to deal with those issues. We believe we're within the ballpark, but that can change daily. So.
Thanks.
Those particular ones were due to natural gas and electricity rate increases that they had to pay.
Yeah, I'm just thinking you can do only so much, I'm sure, by your conservation and alternative methods, but still got to turn on the lights on occasion.
We have to do that. The other issues, we run the risk of conditions of confinement issues and other things in the courts if we take this to the degree that people have hypothermia because of heating problems. So, we can only go so far.
Related.
Thank you for your sensitivity. Yes.
Do you have backup generation capacity for security power if we have brownouts or blackouts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we have in some institutions backup capacity. Nick can talk in more detail to this. It wouldn't allow us to function at the same degree we would normally function at. It's to do primarily security kinds of things, and certain institutions are more complete in those packages than others. Want to add anything to that? Is there?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nick Romenica, Assistant Director of Oregon Department of Corrections, and Mr. Cook is correct. Those are basically for emergency needs.
Larry, go ahead.
And then the last slide there talks to you, just summary for you again, the institutions, there's non-security spans of control displayed there as well for you to see the range that exists both at minimum and medium custody facilities. And attached at the very back.
Is there anything in the span of control we ought to be concerned about? I see the variance, but I don't know whether it makes sense or not.
Chair Miller, Senator Trowe, the department is, 2 years ago, started a project to deal with staffing standards and staff deployment system. They're in the midst of still refining that and implementing it. Whether or not, I guess that's a question best directed to them as to whether or not they believe there are some things they see already in the process that they would adjust. I'm merely able to summarize what they've given me.
Mr. Chair, just, I guess,
Representative
follow up on
Doyle.
That. Thank you. As Larry, you had indicated, I think, in your presentation on the vacancies that they had identified for you the detail of where those vacancies exist.
Yes, I have. I have a list of by position number.
Okay. Does that also give us the, I guess, the detail on how that affects span of control as far as where those vacancies may, or those positions may be in within the span of control?
I guess I'd have to go back to the department to link the two. What they're separate. One's by position number, the other one's by position class number. So I couldn't look at the span of control information, for instance, and say which ones of those positions on the span of control sheets you were handed yesterday have been vacant.
Follow up. Just, I guess what I was looking for, when I see that high a number of vacancies, even a, you know, I guess maybe 93 of them are less than 6 month vacancies. There's still a considerable amount that are over 6 months. And is that, you know, as you prepared the span of control document, are those positions contained within the span of control?
Chair, Representative Doyle, I don't have that information today, and I would believe that what we looked at was just by position number, so the vacancies were not included in those numbers. Some of those vacancies were created to get us to the position we need to be at this biennium when we talk about the loss of 123 positions within the department.
Okay.
I might want to clarify on that. I think the span of control, I could be wrong about this, but Sue, you can help me clarify this. I think the span of control information was given based on approved positions, whether they were filled or not, and based on the current budget and on the governor's rec budget. Is that correct, Sue?
That's correct. All positions would be included in the information we passed out yesterday, which did include the span of control. So it does include all of your vacant positions as well.
So I guess then what I would need just to help analyze the span of control issue is where those vacant positions are, that, and then, you know, how does that change the ratio? So then we can have maybe a clearer picture of you know, where the supervision actually lies.
Chair Hansen, if I might, again, just very quickly, it's probably not necessary, but you have in front of you some information that we have provided, written responses from questions yesterday. Some of that I took around yesterday, the specific questionnaires, the general questions we responded to the committee, and I believe that Mrs. Acuff is still going to have contact with Senator Trowe on a particular issue, and I believe that everything else has been responded to at this point.
Good. Continue.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nick Romenica, Assistant Director of Institution Division for the Department of Corrections. I'm here today to talk about the Institutions Division's narrative budget review. If you look at second tab in your booklet, it talks about Institutions Division. Institution Division is responsible for the security, the housing, and operation of Oregon's incarcerated adult felons. We support and encourage programs to ensure inmates that are in our custody develop the life skills necessary to lead productive lives. The management functions of that division include institution operations, classification and transfer, inmate transportation, security and threat group management, wireless communication, food service administration, interstate compact, emergency preparedness, and institution central administration. There's an organizational chart attached to the back of our document, our narrative, and I think it's pretty well self-explanatory, so I won't go into that. The Institution Division is responsible currently for 13 existing institutions and 14th institution, which is Coffee Creek, under construction. Those are the facilities that you see noted in that page, and I think that is pretty well self-explanatory. On the chart, we'll show you the location of those facilities, I think, that you've already reviewed. I'll try to go through this as quickly as I can so that I try not to repeat some things that have already been presented to the committee. Management to staff ratio, we've had some discussions about that already. Talked about the department has presented a table showing those span of controls. And I think that information has been provided already. The next area that I'd like to address is the program growth. The population forecast for the department has increased. The 9901 shows over 1,000 inmates that have been moved into the Department of Corrections, bringing our total count of over 10,000 inmates. The October 2000 forecast projects that we'll grow by over 900 inmates during 01-03, and that will bring our population to approximately 11,500. As the inmate population shifts, greater number of ballot measure 11 offenders are incarcerated in our system, and the identity of or identifying security threat group members, we continue to need what we call special purpose beds, and those are our intensive management unit, disciplinary segregation unit beds. And so that's why we have to have the flexibility of having those beds available to deal with problem inmates. Most recently, we've had some concerns about the issues at Snake River Correctional Institution in Ontario. We had to move what we call security threat group members into a program, hopefully that will allow them to understand their involvement with gangs is not productive and it's counterproductive. And so we're hoping that this program will bring to light that the need to denounce that group and association. So that was another step why we need special purpose beds within our system and the flexibility to control those populations. Given the fiscal constraints, we understand the need for timely construction of new beds, and it's important that we cover that in detail later on in our budget presentation. I'm moving on to page 3 now and talking about our budget narrative to address phase and occupancy of the three facilities. And I think Mr. McGee covered that earlier today about Snake River, Two River, and Coffee Creek, so I won't reiterate those phase in of population. But the newest facility is Coffee Creek, and I think we've heard some of that testimony already. It's a women's facility and intake center. It will currently, in October, will house minimum custody inmates, 324, and it has the ability in April to house medium custody female inmates of 496 and an intake center of 432.
Chair.
And again,
Senator Trill.
When that facility is fully available, will all women prisoners in the system be in that facility?
Chair, Senator Trow, all women will be in that facility except for Shutter Creek, where we have the boot camp, and there will be some small number of females down there to participate in that time release program.
In terms of projections of female prisoners into the future, or will that facility handle the projections for a number of years?
Chair, Representative Trow, that is correct.
Well, for how many years?
It's geared towards, Chair, Representative Trow, it's geared for the 10-year forecast. As we look at Coffee Creek, as we talked about it, we're going to talk about phasing in those beds, so we won't be occupying all those beds at one time. We're looking at what the population forecast gives us, and that will determine what our rate of occupation, occupying that facility would be. At that time, we again discussed about Columbia River in the Portland area. It would be returned back to a male facility where there's females at today, and EOCI will be returned back to a full male custody facility where we have females in an H unit there. OWCC will be converted to a male minimum facility operated by the Oregon State Penitentiary. I'll move into the next part of our program, which is Measure 17, Program Compliance. And we talked about the Prison Reform Act of 1994, and that's what we call Ballot Measure 17. It's a constitutional mandate to enact, enacted by the people of Oregon, requires inmates to work 40 hours. And the department has increased the percentage of available inmates working full-time from 52% to 75%. The increase is due to three factors, and that's the improvement of efficiencies in managing inmates' assignments within the institution, the growth of number of inmate work crews, and the improvement of within the systems. Efforts to combine work and programs is probably another big accomplishment to allowing us to meet those goals of 40-hour compliance. I'm on page four now of our narrative, and what we talk about there is there's over 8,000 jobs within the system, and what we call Oregon Correctional Enterprise has about 780 of those jobs. Another 1,000 of those jobs are out in the community on minimum work crews. So, and then the rest of those remaining jobs are within the facilities and support of institution operations. And the department is continuing to operate or continue to work with the Department of Military and Natural Resource Agencies to provide opportunities for inmates to reduce the cost of government. That was one of our budget notes that we work with them, and we're continuing to do that, and that has allowed us to increase our work crew operations. And the department is also working with the Natural Resource Agency regarding the National Fire Plan, and that will allow us to better prepare for wildland fires in the year 2000 and beyond, making significant improvements in fire preparedness, fuel load reduction, and other aspects of fire management. The department and Deschutes National Forest have developed a mobile work camp in using inmate labor to accomplish forest health activities. These activities included thinning, hand piling, and wood cutting along the Oregon highways. In 1999, we successfully completed that program. We had another program last year, and we have plans to develop that again, and that keeps 80 inmates out in the forest for approximately 10 weeks. Page 5 shows the cost per day per inmate projected for 2001-2003. I think it's pretty well self-explanatory. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions?
Page 6 talks about cost per day per inmate per facility. That's also pretty well self-explanatory. I'll move on to page 7 that talks about institution division performance measures.
To, when you figure out the cost per day on this chart, you start off with 3174, and then it varies by individuals what things you add in. You obviously add in food and some of these other things. Do you add everything in for every prisoner or not? The other costs, the mental health, alcohol, drug, health services, and so forth. Everybody gets health services, but some use them more than others.
Chair, Senator Trow, this is the average of what it costs.
So it's $3,174, and then you add all the other parts of the pie into it. Total pie is the total cost.
Chair, Senator Trow, that is correct.
I could clarify, too.
Mr. Nice.
The way, manner in which the budget is built is they build a per diem cost in for each inmate per day for all those services, and not necessarily all inmates receive the same level of service. As you point out, some of them have mental health needs, others have higher education needs, but the per diem costs per day are built per day, per inmate, because that's how the budget's built.
Depending on the kind of institution, don't they vary from that standpoint?
Basically, the manner in which the budget's built is based on an average cost.
Just an average cost, okay.
And then they execute the budget by allocating the funds based on the profile of inmates and the expenditure patterns that they experience at each institution.
Okay.
And Chair Miller, Senator Trow, if you turn to page 6, that graph behind essentially answers your question about the cost in the other facilities. For example, at South Fork, that's limited medical service and other things because those inmates are pre-selected because they are not medically at risk, because they have completed other programming, so the cost to supervise and do things in that area are less than they might be in another institution that provides different services for a different type of inmate.
Okay.
Representative Doyle.
It's just along the same lines then, looking at the other side. Why is the intake center such a high cost per day?
Chair Miller and Representative Doyle, the intake center is high for a variety of reasons. We are responsible at the intake center for the provision of the intake process piece of that, the testing and evaluation of the inmates. We purchased the security and the rest of that from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and we're engaged in ongoing contract discussions with them. But because of the intensity of that, the types of contractors that we hire to provide that service, our own staff on site there, it is a more expensive process, but an inmate only spends on average, I think, about 8 days there currently. So it's the entire intaking process outside of women goes through that institution, and it's just the cost of doing business for a very intensive period of time to measure and then ship those inmates to the institutions that they'll be residing in.
Okay, is...
And Coffee Creek comes online, sir, you'll see that process drops to $74.51, and Oregon Correctional Intake Center falls off. We will be turning that facility over to Clackamas County. That'll happen in the spring of next year.
Mr. Chair, if does the backup materials that we've been provided show, I guess, what went into coming up with these average costs and just what... how you arrived at these different figures?
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, I doubt that you have all of the backup material, but that's also information we can certainly provide to you if you want to see that.
Yes, please.
Let me ask a question of the on the intake center. You mentioned now it's an eight-day processing?
Chair Miller, that's correct.
And when you move to Coffee Creek, it's going to be, it's going to be 22 days?
That's correct.
So now how does that compute, I guess, if you've got 8 days at 105 and 22 at practice and it's 74?
It's, Chair Miller, it's approximately $74 per day. That's correct. The thinking that we've had there, and this has been going on for several years, the current process is not driven by need, it's driven by available beds. The intake center has a very small number of beds for use for intake. We make some decisions there very rapidly and move inmates to institutions. The 22-day process is designed to give us more specific information, know more about those inmates, await sentencing orders and other material coming from the counties when they come out of jail, and then make a more specific and better determination about their ultimate destination, reducing the transport costs, doing things of that nature that we run into now. We have inmates that don't get fully intake and assessed before they go to institutions, and we find ourselves making decisions that are probably too rushed in where that inmate should go, and that's all a factor of having to move them through a limited number of beds at the intake center.
On some amount of cases, you're then paying additional expenses to transport that individual to some other institution.
That's correct, or pay it in some other way, because we put them out there without knowing enough about their health care issues, or put them in with people that may be co-conspirators in a crime or some other activity. Generally, that's dealt with, but that eight-day process doesn't answer all the questions.
This will be more important to you, I guess, if you're going to have certain services at certain institutions. You're going to need a little more additional time, I guess, to understand the nature of that offender and where to send them.
That's our belief.
Representative Doyle?
I guess just to follow up on that, I guess maybe the Senator's initial question about looking at 8 days at 105 versus 22 days at $75. I mean, basically we're saying now intake is going from $900 per inmate to $1,650. Does that sound right?
Chair, if I could. The intake center is only a portion of what will be at Coffee Creek Correctional Institution. That's also a women's prison and intake center. So you really need to look at, I think if you look at the OWCC number here, which is right next to Coffee Creek, the larger number of beds are going to be women's beds. So
that figure in.
You've got to combine the women's beds and the intake beds to get to Coffee Creek. You just can't compare just the intake beds to Coffee Creek. That's only about a... third to a quarter of the Coffee Creek beds are intake beds.
Well,
the rest are.
Yes, currently the number is, where did that go? Beds are 324 women's minimums,
496 women's medium and 432 intake beds, so that's approximately right about.
Yeah, so it's actually need to do a weighted average between what you're seeing here for the intake center and the current women's facility when you actually think about what the Coffee Creek costs are going to be.
I guess it's still, and I maybe it's just too early for me, but I'm hearing 22 days of intake, and instead of now, what's 8 days?
Chair, Representative Doyle, I've tried to answer that, and what we're trying to do is put a little bit more dollars on the upfront cost on assessing that inmate, and we believe we'll save dollars on the back end, not transporting that inmate to another facility. I mean, we're winding up paying $61 a day. If that individual is a true minimum, maybe we can move them down to a $38 a day bed. So we want to ensure that we have all the data possible to ensure that we take the right risk in positioning that individual at the right institution.
And how is it that I guess you arrived at the 22-day time period for an intake, just knowing you were looking at that kind of cost just to go through the intake process?
Chair, Representative Doyle, we looked at some of the national standards out there, and California, probably one of the bigger operating facilities, used a 30-day process. We originally asked for 30 days. Because of budget constraints, we cut that back to 22 days.
Hey, Representative Doyle, I can also provide for you, if you wish, essentially this is probably the wrong word to use, but the curriculum for that 22-day intake process, that was worked through by a number of people within the Department of Corrections who have expertise in this process, whether it's health services, program people, or others, classification folks, to arrive at what we figured was the optimal intake process. And as Nick pointed out, it's about investing up front to delay or defer or reduce costs in the future, because if you can take as Nick suggested, an inmate who can directly go to another costly facility, go right into work or do something else, there's cost avoidance, and that was the strategy behind this, not just transport, but permanent assignment in places where you have to then redo an intake process in an institution because it wasn't thorough to begin with.
Okay. And on that curriculum, I guess, is there a way to break out, like, the cost per component of that curriculum?
I hesitate to say that we could break it out cost per component. We could take a run at it. I don't know that it's that finely cut that we can tell you that.
Well, I guess part of my concern is that if you're looking to expand it, you know, so I think significantly from 8 days to 22 days. And I understand the 8 days is because of the physical facility restrictions. And yet, you know, that's still a significant cost. And I certainly agree that the more you can do up front, you know, that you're going to be able to ultimately reduce costs later on makes sense. But I'm also seeing just that we're, at least in this component, that there's it's quite a jump in cost. You know, as we're bringing these inmates in now, you know, it's almost double the expense. And I would be concerned that we're moving in that kind of direction without, you know, I guess that kind of justification to support such an increase in cost as we're looking at all these other budget limitations. So if there is a way to to put something that you know gives us an analysis that we can look at it and say, yeah, that makes sense, then it'd probably be worth the exercise.
Yeah, I'd like to, as we get into this, follow up on that point too, and that is, I understand what you're saying, one about the space limitations, about the 30-day being the optimum. On the other hand, this is too simple, but if we went from 8 to 16, I'd say, well, then you're going to do twice as good a job as you're currently doing, and it won't be as expensive as 22. Now, again, that's too simple. Maybe you can construct a response that says that the current 8-day plan has contributed to these additional expenses with those transfers and attendant problems, but also with an eye that if we can go down from 22 to 16, maybe we can recoup if there are savings and build that drug and alcohol program or build that recreational activity program, the anger management kind of thing, and restore that. And obviously all these things are balances, choices. But just please be prepared to, we'll have some discussion about that. Representative Hansen?
Well, I think if we're looking at the 22 days and the $76 cost, one of the things you've got a cost avoidance of an average of $61 no matter where you put them. So really it's the difference between what the $74 a day and $61 a day. So those additional days in intake are really only costing you $15 a day. The other thing I would guess is that if you're moving some of those functions that are occurring during those 22 days, if you're moving them out to the institutions, they've got average costs, but the new people coming in their first week, their first 2 weeks in an institution are probably going to be more expensive than average. So if you can centralize some of these orientation things in one spot, you're probably saving more money than if you're trying to do little orientation projects throughout a whole bunch of institutions. So I don't think there's a lot of money that we can probably save here, and it's probably not costing us a whole lot to do it. But and this was part of the discussion we got into on 1145 and the cost allocation through 1145. The shorter term somebody's there, or when they first arrive in an institution, it's not average cost. They're a lot more expensive. That's when they're going to need most of their medical stuff. You don't go into prison with your teeth in good shape. There's just a lot more stuff that happens when they first hit the door.
Let us see if we can put a little finer point on this. The discussion is valuable. The discussion we've had internally, whether or not we've cut it as finely as Representative Doyle would like or others, that's debatable, whether we can in fact do that. What we might be able to do is take a couple of examples of an average inmate that we see and sort of walk them through the process and see whether or not there's, it's going to be, we'll approach this in some way that might be instructive. So.
Thank you. Senator Trow, did you?
I think most of my questions have been asked, and they were good questions, but I would think that it might be possible to cut down the days that you need to do this by few and maybe save some money that way.
We actually had people lobbying for as many as 45 days.
I'm sure.
It's all over the board. Yeah. Why 22? It's an excellent question. Yeah. So.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll move on to page 7 of our narrative, Institution Division Performance Measures. They were developed to assist in measuring how successful we do our job. And in interest of time, I'll cover 3 of the 6 measures that are currently on this document. And I'll talk about the first one, inmate walkaways, and that deals with inmates who are in minimum custody who walk away from work crews. It seems to be a topic of interest. We are working with Representative Crummell on a bill that deals with inmate walkaways and supervision of work crews. And the number of inmates who walk away from outside crews, our expectation should not exceed 1.8 per 1,000. Currently, as of January, we're 0.5. We've had one inmate walk away out of one of our facilities from work crew, and that's per 1,000 inmates. In 97, we had approximately 29 inmates who've walked away from one of our work crews. In 98, we had 28, 99, we had 34, and of the year 2000, we had 14. So that just kind of gives you a number that we talk about when we talk about walkaways. We'll move on to page 8, and we talk about inmate work.
Nick, just to go back, those numbers you gave on the different years, 34?
Was the year of 1999.
And 2000?
Chair Representative Doyle, that was 14.
Any thoughts on why there's such a dramatic reduction?
We were able to take a more aggressive stance on working with the communities in addressing prosecution and prosecution for those who assist an inmate to walk away. And we also worked on doing spot checks with our work crews, and we have to probably say that a lot of that is to not only educating our staff, but educating the inmates the consequences for those walkaways.
Is there a difference between a walkaway and just an outright, like a more of a prison break escape type of thing? You know, where I guess I look at walkaways more as the work crews. But are you have you had other incidents where it's just besides people walking away from work crews?
Chair, Representative Doyle, that's correct, and those are categorized as escapes.
Okay. And do we have those somewhere? Those numbers?
Chair, Representative Doyle, no, we do not have those numbers available. I can make those numbers available for you. And we had one escape, two inmates escape from Snake River most recently.
Do you have an idea over the last couple of years how many we have?
Chair, Representative Doyle, I don't have that information, but I will get you that information.
And one more follow-up. Been discussion about the having the police academy move over nearby the Salem prison sites. Do you see any advantage to having 300 or 400 sworn officers nearby the prison if, in case there's any kind of escape or walkaways?
Chair, Representative Doyle, eyes and ears are in a location is always a good thing to have.
Is that a done deal?
Well,
you say talking like it.
I've heard other locations.
Yeah, I have too. I just.
Chair members of the committee.
No, I'm not too good at location deals.
Yeah, right.
I'll move on to inmate work. The expectations for the compliance of Measure 17 was to remain above 75% as of January 2000, which is normally one of our lower months because of the holidays and other time off periods for academic folks, that dropped down to 79%. We have been averaging over 80% on that benchmark. The next one I'll move through, and I'm sure that everybody's probably interested in, is staff assaults. We feel that one assault is too many. We had a spike in March in Snake River. We're continuing to work with the union and with the managers there to identify the concerns to assist in addressing the reason for those assaults. As I talked about earlier, we moved some what we believe individual inmates who were security threat group members from that facility. As of today, we do not have any assaults this month in that facility. We look at the expectations of assaults. Our expectation of class one assaults not exceed one per 1,000, and that's approximately three per month. The rate as of today is 1.5. We're also looking at House Bill 2646, which will raise the level of assaults to a class three assault for a public safety officer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Trow.
Of course, nobody wants to see anybody being assaulted one way or the other, but are we also thinking about how conditions within the institutions can be kept at a level of acceptable treatment so that, that anger is managed and we don't get prisoners to the point where they feel like assaulting somebody?
Chair, Representative Trow, what we're working with is dealing with the inmates and they're controlling the groups and how large those groups would be in the recreation yard. We've also identified areas that we can improve upon. We're looking at our staff. We're looking at our staff who probably need additional training in communicating with inmates and hopefully be able to de-escalate situations. So we also looked at providing our staff with equipment that would keep them safe in breaking up assaultive type of activities, and that's chemical agents on those response teams. So we've looked at the areas that we believe are the hot spots in that facility where those assaults are occurring, and we're looking to address those with various techniques.
Well, I think you're going to have a lot better chance at keeping things at an even keel if you have plenty of activities and there's not a lot of idleness. And a lot of these things that are being cut down on, I think, are going to create the kind of atmosphere where people may be be more frustrated. It may take those things out in behaviors that we don't condone, but keeping them busy, keeping them feeling like they've got something meaningful to do is part of the therapy they need.
Chair, Senator Throw, we agree with that.
All right. Are you at a place where it's convenient to stop?
Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. The House is in session at 10 o'clock this morning. Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, I did want to introduce my guest.
Please do.
She is the famous Kate Brown from Madeline School. She's an eighth grader, and her mother, you may know, is Elise Brown. She works for AT&T, and her father is Rich Brown, Bank of America. So, Kate, welcome. The more Kate Browns, the merrier, I think.
Nice to have you here, Kate. Thanks for coming. And thank you for your testimony, and we appreciate the information you also provided in response to questions that we had yesterday. Senator
yes.
Brown, you might find
thank you.
For you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Chair Miller, no, I'm assuming that we begin again on Monday. Is that correct?
That's correct. We'll begin on Monday, and I know that representatives Doyle and Leonard want to do some work on this budget, work their magic as they did on the state police budget with you, and I know you look forward, of course, to that experience.
Chair, again, I think a lot of whatever is done in terms of working magic ought to be done publicly within the subcommittee so that we all know. I don't mind some things not being done here, but I think it all should be reported here.
Oh, I'm
so
sure
know what's going on.
Us,
yeah, because we're all involved, and this is a small subcommittee.
All right, thank you. And if there's nothing further to come before the committee, we are adjourned.
Glad I walked all the way down here.
Yeah.